Hey everyone, you're listening to another episode of Big Shiny Takes. I am one of your hosts, Eric Wickham, and I'm joined by Jeremy Appel.
Hello.
And I'm also joined by my other co-host, Marino Greco.
Hi, I'm here live.
You're here and you're on time and you look wonderful. Jeremy, back home in Edmonton. How's the weather out there?
I mean, by the time this episode's out, it's going to be summer. So,
well, by the time you book you the next guest, it'll probably be winter. So we'll get another three episodes in for the rest of the year. And they're going to be like absolute bangers.
Depth, not breadth, as a wise man once said as justification for firing me.
No shit. I don't think you've once complained about this once to me, Jeremy. Okay, yeah, no.
I honestly think that's my favorite blog post that talked about firing one of my friends. And not because I agreed with the idea of firing one of my friends, but because it was just like so self-aggrandizing. Like, I don't know. It was just very dramatic is what I'm trying to get to.
I actually have a friend who also has worked with this person, and like they send stuff to me, like their Facebook posts over the years, and it's just like really cringy shit. Anyways, yeah, self-aggrandizing, you nailed it.
Yeah, it's really embarrassing. Anyways, I've always maintained that if you're going for depth, not breadth, you don't actually have to fire people to get that. Maybe the problem was that you aggressively expanded before your company was ready to take more people on. Anyways, we are joined as well by a special friend of the Institute all the way out in Alberta, Stephen Maguziak. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good to see you guys again. Eric is also a friend of my Institute, so there's some incestuous stuff going on here, but I'm here for it. And Jeremy has also contributed to the Institute on multiple occasions and is also a guest on my thing, so yeah, this is a bro one.
It is weird editing Jeremy on the podcast that I edit for you on the Press Progress feed, just because it's just like,
really?
No, it's just like the feeling of like the overlap. It's very strange, and then I forget which podcast I'm editing, et cetera, et cetera.
We stick together, but yeah, no, we're not here to talk about us. We're here to talk about certain other important figures in Canadian media.
Well, you know, it's every sicko's favorite week, the one where the budget is proposed and every dork with a Twitter profile gets excited about what shoes the finance minister is going to be wearing. And then they proceed to screech about how the government is spending money, but in the wrong ways for the next, what, month? Like, how long of a runway do we have on budget whinging, basically?
I feel like it's a year-round thing. In that, like, the takes about the budget in particular come and go. But then throughout the year, we are subject to incessant whining from the same people in passing in all their other articles outlining their petty personal grievances to remind us that you know, we are nowhere on target to meet our NATO targets of 2% of GDP defense spending. Now, why 2% is never asked. Why that was agreed to, right? We're never told why. That's just the magic number that we have to hit. But we also have to be concerned about the debt.
Yeah, and so we need to be spending money, but only spending money on killing people or making things to kill people. But, you know, housing or healthcare or actual infrastructure in the country or lunches for school children. Like, no, we can't afford that. We need more fighter jets.
Well, and more non-lethal military exports to Israel.
But as for, like, the news value piece, I just want to flag that, like, yes, budget's very important. But in terms of news value, like, if you were to, like, just, like, go up to someone at Safeway and start asking them about, like, their opinions about the budget, do you think they'd have one? Because nobody gives a fuck about the budget. Nobody gives a fuck about the deficit. They think you're a crazy person and tell you to go away.
Yeah. like, but Andrew Coyne, who we're talking about in particular, has never actually spoken to a person that wasn't during a job interview or on a TV panel. So, you know, you gotta cut him some slack there. Yeah, no, can you imagine going to a food bank and telling people there that the debt is too high and we're not spending enough for the privilege of being part of NATO?
I'm in line of Shoppers and I'm just asking the woman in front of me, like, are you aware that we're not reaching our 2% NATO GDP targets? And then being escorted out by security is probably how that would go. But
this man is harassing me. He keeps talking about the capital gains tax. It really is. It's a tough conversation to have with somebody who is in line to get, you know, a loaf of bread and some non-perishables. It's a real tough ask to get someone angry about the capital gains tax being raised for any capital gains over 250K or something, right? Like, it is something that doesn't affect the average Canadian.
No normal person has a strong opinion on this. Like, I'm not even... I keep referencing, like, grocery stores, but, like, anywhere. Like, just on the street, anyone, nobody, no normal Canadian that you see just walking around at the bus stop or just, like, walking around the mall. Like, nobody's paying attention to it. It's a very niche topic, but here we are talking about it, and we should be talking about it, but yeah, right. I just want to flag it.
Yeah, and so it's like, you can't have too much debt, because then you're wasting money on debt service payment. It's okay, fair enough. You can't increase taxes, because that's bad for job creating.
Yeah, it's communism.
Yeah, and you know, in Alberta, you know, Stephen and I can tell you all about the jobs that were eliminated due to automation in the tar sands after Jason Kenney gave the big oil companies billions of dollars in tax cuts. But you know, that's just the formula. It's the magic. It's the spell. Right, from, because people understand politics through Harry Potter. So it's the spell you say, and then you cut taxes, or at least don't raise them, and then jobs materialize, right? Science.
My understanding is that if we raise the capital gains tax, we're losing our tech sector. All the tech billionaires are just going to shun us.
They're all going to run away. They're going to go back to their private islands.
Right, and we don't want that. We don't want that, so... What is to be done? What is
yeah,
done?
And then what else? Well, sorry, what else are we not allowed to have in the budget? We can't spend on housing, right? We don't want, like, we want to encourage people to build more houses, but not make it so people can afford them, because that's left wing ideology. And we also have to increase military spending. And so, what does that leave us with?
There's honestly some stuff on the piece that we're going to be discussing, if I'm understanding this correctly, a couple pieces, but housing being one of them. And there was a very bizarre line about the increase for demand for housing being a problematic thing. And someone smarter on this panel might need to actually just spell this out for me. Like, I'm five.
So that's the coin piece, which we're talking about right now. And yeah, I think what coin is referring to is just neoliberal ideology that when you increase supply, things automatically become more affordable. And mm-hmm. you don't have to worry about demand. An equilibrium gets reached, right? Automatically.
Whereas how is it increasing demand, though? Like, that's the part I don't get. So, like, here's, like, another parallel example. You build a pipeline, a planet cooking pipeline, you're increasing the supply of fossil fuels. This will increase demand and increase carbon emissions. How does that translate to housing, though? Like, is that the same, like, economic principle he's referring to, or?
Well, no, of course. He's not referring to any economic principle. There's no fuck all about economics. I mean, no one does. Least of all economists. But no. So there's this assumption that, right, supply and demand, you build more houses, the price of housing decreases, which is dumb bullshit, because if you look at the statistics from the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, if you like look at Edmonton, for example, let's talk about, or Calgary, an even worse case, where you have more houses being built. And so by that logic, the share of affordable housing would also increase, right? Meaning affordable housing, meaning cost 30% of
your monthly income before taxes. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're talking about a very long, very convoluted article from Andrew Coyne, where he basically just, I think as Eric said, negs the budget. Towards the very end, he had a very just bizarre line to me that I've been trying to just unpack what the fuck he's talking about. He basically just bashes Canada on not doing enough to, or not succeeding rather, in becoming a world power and things like artificial intelligence, blah, blah, blah. And he says, okay, here's the paragraph. A similar sense of inadequacy pervades the document being the budget. There are some useful sounding measures to increase the supply of housing. And then in brackets, he says, and some not so useful measures to increase demand. That's the part that kind of like set off my alarm, but because like, what is he talking about? But nothing like on the scale required. And then he goes on to say this stuff about defense spending, which I'm sure we'll get into. Defense spending will get a boost, but nowhere near as much or as soon as the gathering world security crisis demands. So those are kind of two completely separate things going on in one paragraph there. But I'm trying to figure out the bracketed part, the not so useful measures to increase demand.
I think like there's got to be something in the budget specifically that probably helps out first home buyers or something that would incentivize people to buy.
Yeah, some like micro targeted bullshit that isn't going to do anything.
I actually like just want this for my clarification, because like this isn't like an immigration dog whistle or anything like that.
No, it's not. We will get to the immigration dog whistles or rather air horns, right, okay. Shortly.
Yeah, klaxons. Yeah.
But so basically Coyne is engaging in this neoliberal dogma that there's a finite good, you have a certain amount of it, it costs X amount because the market gods have decided that's what it's worth, and then you build more of it and there's the same demand, the price goes down. And this is why people blame immigration for high housing prices, because it's like, oh, we're building more homes, but still too many immigrants are coming in. Now, the problem with that logic is you would assume then that the more housing is built, as is the case in Edmonton and Calgary, the share of housing that's affordable would increase. But it's not. Housing construction has increased in Calgary and Edmonton. They're building more homes, but the share of homes that are affordable are decreasing, because it turns out that if you're a developer, you're not building homes so that people can live in them and afford to live in them and live fulfilling lives. You're building homes that people can buy for the most amount of money and then do whatever the fuck they want with them. Rent them out as an Airbnb, use them as a tax write-off, hold on to them as an investment and flip them later. So really, I mean, the housing crisis is such a good embodiment of why these classical economic assumptions regarding supply and demand don't hold any water.
Yeah, no, it's completely baby brain shit, right? The idea that if we just build enough, there's only so many Canadians, right? So we can get a house for every Billy, Joe, and Susan, right? The fact that we have an investor class that is rabid about housing has completely skewed the demand in this country, right? There's a story that came out 3 or 4 years ago in Toronto where they said a quarter, I think it was a Better Dwelling piece, but in it, the writer said that a quarter of all new builds in Toronto, which, I mean, for the large part are one-bedroom and studio apartments, luxury studio apartments, one quarter of those were bought by someone with four or more properties already. And it's like, those units are specifically built for the purpose of investment. They're not for someone trying to make a family or, you know, settle down in the city. And I think the piece that we get into blames condos for that, which I think is like a very stupid thing. But it's like, it's not the actual building's fault. It's these forces that are pushing these buildings to be made. And it's also not what he thinks it is. But I mean, I guess I'm teasing it now. Do you guys want to talk about this column that we're about to read?
I do. But first, I am very concerned about what this means for birth rates of Canadian babies. And I want to get into that immediately. But I'm also worried about the defense spending piece that Coin does bring up later in the article, because while he basically just laments everything in the budget, the one thing he does complain about is that we're not increasing defense spending so much. Why would Coin be so invested in increasing defense spending? Are we in a time of global crisis for security? Do we really need to defend the Arctic? I'm worried. I'm scared. I'm like hiding under my desk right now.
Well, yeah, something about Russia wanting to conquer Canada once it's done with Donbass. The next step is obviously coming to our doorsteps.
Going over the Arctic.
You have to be afraid. Yeah, so it's good that you're afraid. It means that you are an informed citizen, and maybe you can get a column at a fancy newspaper one of these days.
Do you have Adam Zivo's email? I might shoot him.
I think you'd probably find it with relative ease. I mean, that guy is nothing if not a quote shark who certainly has had business cards since he was in like high school.
And he's like one of those guys that just like anybody who just shows up in like a conflict zone, like say Ukraine during a time of conflict, and then he's writing about mayoral elections from Ukraine, from like Odessa or wherever the fuck he is. You know that person's on the level. Like they're a serious like journalist, nothing sus going on.
Yeah, no,
there,
he's
right?
He's super normal, and he's up for a national, or he was nominated for a national newspaper award. Did he win?
I don't know. I'm pulling for Fawcett.
Yeah.
Let's fucking go, Max. Make us proud. Bring it home.
Right back to the center where it belongs, baby.
Anyways, thank you for answering that, fellas. I'm gonna
go. Well, I am not a lot of people know this, but you know how people can get certification to officiate weddings.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's also like that with economics. It just costs more.
Let's talk about Ibbotson super quick. Who is John Ibbotson? What are some of his highlights, lowlights? How should people understand Ibbotson just in general?
Okay, so Ibbotson wrote a book called The Big Shift. It was a book about how Canada's going to go completely conservative because immigrants are going to fuel a wave of like conservative politics across Canada. This was written in about 2012 to 2014. I can't remember the exact year. It turned out to be dead wrong. And now we're a decade later. I mean, of course, we are now facing a Polyev takeover, but Ibbotson is an idiot. But basically, that book was a huge embarrassment.
Maybe he's
and not. He just writes like conservative shit for the Globe and Mail. Anyways, Jeremy, yeah, take it away.
Yeah, well, exactly. He's like a center-right Globe and Mail shithead who, as a reporter, sort of drifted between the Southam papers and the Globe and the National Post, and has fingers in a lot of pies. Every once in a while, he'll have a column where it's like, oh, wow, like Broken Clock is right twice a day. Thank you, Captain Obvious, kind of stuff. But obviously, yeah, The Big Shift is definitely the thing you need to know about him. He has a tendency to be totally wrong 99% of the time. Other things you should... Oh, he wrote a really dog shit book on Stephen Harper, right, in 2015, where you can learn some really important factoids about Harper like that. He's a big Seinfeld fan.
Oh. Oh, wow.
No, I actually read it for the Kenny book. There was one page that I found helpful in talking about Harper's legacy on criminal justice issues that was a succinct summary. So again, like 1% of the time, John Ibbotson is fine and you might actually learn something from him. 99% of the time, it's just like, oh my God, retire, retire. This guy's like older than my dad. My dad's retired.
Yeah. One other thing I want to flag about Ibbotson is he did write a book in 2019 that touches on the topic that we're going to go into in this article that I believe none of us have read and probably never will, but he's very, very interested in fertility rates and population decline in Canada. So
every single time, I swear to God.
Just flagging
it. Well, and also he was one of the, oh, we need to let the PPC into the debates.
Yeah, free speech, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, right. Like this headline, this banger of a headline right here. The People's Party is far outside the mainstream of Canadian politics, but it deserves representation. Which is, I mean, that is really a John Ibbotson take, right? It's just like, yes, this thing is true, but also this other thing that is only tangentially connected to it. And I think that is really sort of what he does in this piece we're about to read.
Yeah, he can't help himself, really. It's very annoying. Anyways, what I was going to say about his book is, like, I'm not going to read it, but I will listen to Steve Paikin interview him because he has a political book, and that's all that Paikin ever does.
Yeah, if you didn't give him free labor that he was unsatisfied with, he'll have you on to talk about your political book.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Anyways, let's get into this fucking piece. Steven, you've been on the show, I think, like five times now. But you know how this goes. We usually let the guest read the dog shit column. Feel free to stop wherever you'd like.
All right. Okay, so the headline here is housing plan's impact on Canada's fertility rate would strain economy, increase social tensions, by John Nelson.
Huge if true.
Yeah, huge if true. So it begins, the federal government's new budget is largely dedicated to building more homes faster so that young workers can afford to own one. The Conservative housing plan claims to do the same, only better. There's one problem. These plans would further force down Canada's fertility rate, straining our economy and increasing social tensions.
Okay, there's a lot of like missing things in these two paragraphs. Like, how does the Conservative housing plan claim to do the same but better? And then what is the Liberals' plan, right? Like, this is just like, there are two plans. There's one plan and the other plan is the same plan but better. It's just on steroids. And then just the claim out of nowhere that this is going to further force down our fertility rates. The housing plan just in itself.
Yeah, that escalated really quickly.
It's
yeah, it's the fertility rate stuff that just like sets off the Kill Bill alarm.
Yeah.
Siren.
I think it's sweet that he's thinking about how much that he's thinking about young people fucking a lot.
He's just thinking about beautiful babies, like a very specific kind of baby.
The Canadian race. Yes. Like, what the fuck are you talking about? Anyone worried about fertility rates immediately sets off like,
oh yeah.
Yeah, like Metal Gear Solid, yeah. Like
they should like, be that, like, forced to describe what the baby looks like specific things, you know.
Yeah.
What economic class were they born in? What color is their skin? Maybe that'd be an interesting thing to ask John.
And we'll probably unpack this later in the article, but like you can make the argument that comes down to just like labor power, like just pure economics, but I can't just disentangle it from like a racial aspect and like white replacement theory. I'm not saying that that's what Ibbotson's going for, but it gives that to me.
Yeah, it's definitely time, giving right? White replacement theory. I don't think John Ibbotson believes in white replacement theory. Which makes this column even more baffling.
Mm-hmm. I do think like these guys, all these center rights and right wingers that get a little bit too into birth rates are also the same people that kind of freak out about the idea of a lack of national identity. And I think the idea that if there were more Canadians, more natural born Canadians, I guess, that there'd be an easier way of having some sort of cohesive national identity. But I don't think that's true. Two, I think the concept of what a Canadian is irrelevant to my well-being. And three, it's creepy. Like, it's creepy just talking about white babies all the time.
And why is having less babies going to increase social tensions? Wouldn't having more babies increase social tensions because there are more people to have? And what do you mean social tensions?
He's talking about when the friends who want to have kids in the friend group clash with the friends who don't want to have kids in the friend group, based on a true story.
Oh, it gets into this later on, Marino. And then he goes on to say, densification. So now we're talking about like the real housing shit. Densification, fourplexes as of right, infill, and high rises near transit hubs all conspire to ensure Canadians have fewer and fewer babies. What the fuck? Okay, sorry. This continues. Sorry, the paragraph's not even done. There's a lot to unpack here. And then he goes on to say, environmentalists cheer that outcome. But anyone who wants reliable health care, sorry, this is this a batshit article. Environmentalists cheer that outcome. But anyone who wants reliable health care or a good education for their children or clean drinking water or safe streets, what is he talking about? Or any of these things, or any of the things essential to a stable, happy society, shouldn't worry. Lots going on in this paragraph. So.
Holy fuck.
I mean, that first sentence is the dumbest shit I've ever heard, right? Like, the idea that a type of building is conspiring against the Canadian way of life that he has imagined in his head.
I don't know if you're aware of this, Eric, but, like, people don't have babies unless they have backyards and, like, giant, like, McMansions. It just doesn't happen. I mean, throughout history, going back to, like, the ancient Sumerians.
Exactly. They needed a fence and like, a front lawn and, yeah. You know, a driveway, yeah, a two-car garage.
It's the fall of civilization otherwise.
I mean, I don't think Ibbotson is like very serious as a person, because if he was actually going to make an argument about, you know, plunging birth rates, maybe he should be looking at like the material conditions of a working class person in a city like Toronto, where the only places they can afford are one bedrooms and studio apartments, typically in lower levels of units, or are staying home. It's like, the problem isn't that it's in a fourplex. The problem is there's not enough space for a baby. And the reason that they're living in that space with their partner, probably, is because everything else they've been priced out of. And so, like, this is a housing argument when someone doesn't have any class analysis. You know what I mean? And then it just gets weird about babies.
It also says a lot about Ibbotson, because, like, I actually live in a neighborhood with a lot of infills, and I don't live in one. I live in, like, an ancient house with a super racist landlord, and it's kind of a dump, to be honest, but I have clean drinking water. What the fuck is he talking about, the clean drinking water part? Or good education. There's like so many great schools like within like a block of where I live, and the streets are safe. Like, they, like, this is a man who lives in an absolute fucking bubble, and it just says so much in this paragraph.
Why would infill and high rises have different drinking water than the rest of the city?
Right. And also, infills are nice. Like, when I walk through the neighborhood, I look at the infills and being like, damn, like, these people must be like doing pretty all right. Like, I would happily raise a family in one of these had I had a family. Like, I'm just like, that is a sweet ass backyard. That is a very nice looking house. You know what I mean? Like, what's the problem here? But it's just not up to Ibbotson's like particular standard of what a suitable house would look like to raise a family.
It's like Hillary Clinton walking in on that constituent or whatever with the plant in the sink, like, oh God, what is this hellhole?
Exactly, Marino. Like it's like she had never seen a ceiling that low in her entire life. And it like shows on her face. But like, these are nice places. Like, infills are nice. Like, infills, I'm sorry, but like, infills are fancy. Like all the ones in my area. And I live in a very mixed neighborhood. So, like, it just speaks to what an elite asshole Ibbotson is, frankly.
No, and he's kind of a dumbass, too, because it's like, you can have high-rises with plenty of bedrooms. The problem is, the people that are building these don't build three-bedroom condos because they make less money on that because there's fewer units to sell. And so, like, the fact that they maximize the amount of units per square foot is a problem, right? Like, I think that would be a more interesting argument. I'm writing this piece for Ibbotson now. We should probably get back into it.
So, sorry, he had just said, like, are any of these things essential to a stable, happy society? Shouldn't worry. And then he says, couples who want to have children generally prefer a house with several bedrooms and a backyard. It's like, okay, well, I mean, that's achievable without, like, single detached suburbs, but I'm digressing here. The kind of house so many of us grew up in. Mm. All right. This kind of house has fallen out of favor with planners and urbanists because to be affordable, it needs to be built on the cheap land found at even beyond the edges of cities, requiring expensive new infrastructure, the paving over of farmland, and long car commutes to work, all of which contribute to global warming. All right. That's the cause of global warming.
He's doing Return, but for the suburbs.
Right.
It's just like this weird, like, imagined past or this memory of a place that didn't really exist. The reason my parents moved to the suburbs when they had kids was because it was cheap.
Mm-hmm.
They moved from a suburb to a farther suburb to save money. And now those suburbs are just as expensive, right? There's places in my parents' neighborhood that are going for like $1.2 million.
Right.
They should not be that expensive. There is no point in moving there because I feel like most young families who are looking for a starter home don't have $1 million kicking around for some reason. I don't know. Maybe I'm projecting a little much.
Yeah, no, full disclosure, I'm a fail son. My sister is a success daughter and lives in one of those suburbs with her two kids. And it's lovely. And I get the argument and I have no judgment for people who go that path. It's just his basic thesis that people are going to have fewer babies if we don't keep building more of these fucking things is just absolutely insane to me. I mean, like, what is like what examples, like, we should read his book, I guess, because like, I can't even imagine what examples he would cite to somehow tie this particular kind of housing to fertility and birth rates in a country when most countries on earth don't build cities like this. Like, this is kind of a unique North American phenomenon. Like, am I insane here?
No. I mean, since the dawn of time, we had white picket fences, though, and subdivisions. This is just a thing. This is how ancient Egypt looked. The population only grows when people have garages.
We're contributing to global warming,
right?
By building these. That's what's contributing to global warming. That's the big problem.
It's the only thing.
That's the issue. Far better to densify existing neighborhoods, goes the theory. To concentrate populations near services and infrastructure. Sure. Have you looked at birth rates lately? He asks. When Daryl Bricker and I started researching Empty Planet, The Shock of Global Population Decline, which is a book that we all promise we're going to read. And
yeah, definitely.
Be fairly. 8 years ago, Canada's fertility rate was 1.6 children per woman. Half a baby short of the replacement rate. Replacement. of 2.1 needed to keep the population stable. Today, the rate has swooned to 1.3. So we're at low birth rates, people. We should be sweating. Fertility rates in developed and many developing societies, okay, were falling before the pandemic, and COVID-19 suppressed them even further. So this is a man who's very, very concerned about fertility rates, which is just, as we've established earlier, very normal stuff, folks. I just want to be very clear here. I don't think Ibbotson is going for like white replacement stuff here.
Right.
But it's weird, right? It's very weird.
Mm-hmm.
Like shitty settlers, like inner city settler colonial society. Like, why are you so worried about birth rates?
I think the thing that bothers me specifically about this is there are so many good reasons not to have children right now. And like, all you have to do is like go outside and look around. Like 16% of households in Ontario faced food insecurity in 2022. The food bank lineups are huge. Housing is ridiculous. The homeless population is skyrocketing in cities all over the country because there's housing crises in every major metropolitan area. It's like people can't afford to have kids, and so they're not. It's like a responsible choice to not just like have a kid when you're barely hanging on.
And it's also like, what jobs are they filling or something? Like, what's the point of like adding all these extra bodies?
Yeah. And like, I want to get in that, like, people who want to have kids, like, great, do it. Like, if you're there, do it. Like, that sounds great. I'm not there personally, but, and I probably won't be, but a lot of my good friends are having babies, and when they do, I get super excited for them. Like, there's no like anti-natalist sentiment, which Ibsen will come to later in the article, that I'm aware of. Like, I've never met anyone who's like, don't have babies, you selfish asshole. Yeah. You fucking like don't like spawn crotch goblins and like you fucking breeders. Like, that's just all fake shit. that I've never actually encountered in real life.
That's like imaginary stuff, right? But it's like the point I'm trying to get to is that like there are plenty of reasons to not have children. And I feel like we should respect people's decision to not, the same way that we would respect people who have decided to have them, right? Like, I think it's a hard decision to make. I think people would feel like they're missing out on a very large part of life not having kids. But I think it doesn't make sense for some people. And so they choose not to. And like Ibbotson is like convinced it's the altitude in which they're living or like how many people are in the same building that's preventing it. It seems so pretend.
Yeah, he like later suggests that there's like a movement involved, which we're going to get to in a second here. So it's like, okay, so now he's going to cite a bunch of examples in other countries. About 2/3 of people in Spain are apartment dwellers. The fertility rate there is 1.2. And the country has started losing population. But only 1/3 of the people next door in France live in apartments. And the fertility rate there is 1.7, though it is also declining. And it goes on, about 10% of Australians live in apartments. The fertility rate there is 1.6. On the other hand, more than 60% of South Koreans live in apartments, and South Korea has the world's lowest fertility rate, 0.7, in 2024, according to government projections. He's literally blaming high-density housing for low birth rates, which just, what the fuck? Like, you can't do that. Like, people have had children under the worst circumstances possible. Like, in, like, places of, like, extreme war and conflict, birth rates actually tend to skyrocket. Don't ask me for sources on that, but...
Well, and he also mentions that there are all these other factors leading to declining birth rates, but then goes on to say, oh, but it's actually densification that is leading to it in all these examples without explaining why.
Like, it matters to him. So that's the most important thing. It's the only thing that fits his argument. So we're going with densification. Yeah. I mean... Like, beyond Stephen's point about the birth rates in war-torn countries, pre-industrial society, people were having, like, a dozen kids, right? And it's like all of these post-industrial countries seem to have declining birth rates. And maybe it's because they don't have a farm that needs extra hands and, like, free labor who maintain. Maybe that has something to do with it, John.
That's definitely a better reason than fucking apartments existing. Like, does John Ibbotson think people exist and make decisions in service of, like, the economy or Canada's national fabric? Who gives a shit? People should just do what they want, and you need to cope, you weird old man. Stop thinking about it.
Yeah, but Marino, so what? And that's my segue into the next paragraph. So what? Some will ask. Earth will breathe easier with fewer people. True. But a below replacement fertility rate, especially one that is steadily falling, means that each year there are fewer workers available to fill jobs, pay taxes, consume goods, support the elderly, and generally keep things running.
Yeah, delivering him his food on Skip the Dishes, right?
Right.
Like, there it is. There it is.
Right? Yeah.
So if we have more density and people have more options to choose from and where they want to live, who's going to get me my Skip the Dishes or drive my Uber, which ought to lead one to inquire whether maybe that's a bigger factor
right
in reducing birth rates, the fact that everyone needs to work like three jobs with no benefits in order to survive.
Right.
That no one can afford housing, whether it's dense or not, right? I mean, that's almost that is a separate issue from affordability, the lack of housing density, right? Because if density led to affordability, then Vancouver would be the most affordable place to live in Canada rather than the least or second least.
But this entire argument is like based on Ibbotson worrying that there's not going to be an underclass to get him his shit, which is like annoying, right? Like, he's not, you know, worried about who's going to do this work. Because, I mean, if he was worried about that, he would go and do that. He put down the pen. But no, he's worried about who's going to do this stuff for me. And that's really embarrassing. I don't care for this piece at all.
I'm astounded that, like, he continues to maintain this, like, sterling columnist position, as I am often on this show. Just, like, this dude makes so much money to write shit like this that it's just, like, it's barely even coherent. Like, he's not even proving his, like, work. What's the point of reading this?
One of the things that he does in this that really bothers me is, like, twice in the last paragraph, he does, like, a, but fuck all that shit. All those, like, cogent points. Here's my dumb one.
Yes, I'm back. Shall I continue?
Yes, please.
I think we were already talking about how we were already seeing growing unhappiness in Missouri. We were talking about keeping things running, supporting the elderly, making sure that John Ibsen gets his Uber and whatnot, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, my internet crashed out for a second there. So we are already seeing growing unhappiness among workers who believe they will never enjoy the life their parents had. Yeah, no shit.
Yeah, I wonder why.
Wait till the degrowthers. I love this sentence. Just let's savor this sentence. Wait till the degrowthers and the neonatalists start going at it. The former want to effectively socialize the economy to ensure equity as growth turns to decline. The latter want to encourage, even force, women to quit school, stay at home, and have more babies. Okay.
Who's to say who's right, who's wrong?
Someone needs to explain what neonatalists are. Who are like, what is this? I've never seen this term before.
They want people to have more babies. Like John Ibbotson is dog whistling the neonatalists with this piece, because otherwise he wouldn't write it, because it's like, who cares about that shit except for complete fucking weirdos.
Yeah, it's weird that he warns people about them in a piece that is like explicitly for them, right? And then again, like, we are already seeing growing unhappiness among young workers. Why? What's going on with young workers? Why are they unhappy? Is it because, like, the cost of living is incredibly high and their wages don't cover it?
And jobs are fucking terrible. And, like, a million things when they used to be one or two things.
I have to be honest, fellas. I wish we had more time to talk about degrowthers. I have thoughts, but I know the clock's ticking. And
we'll have an entire episode about anarcho-primitivism and how super smart the idea is.
Oh yeah, totally. And how John Sarazan is totally a natural phenomenon.
Yeah.
I will continue. Neonatalist policies are fixtures of illiberal democracies such as Viktor Orban's Hungary and animate parts, especially the alt-right parts, of conservatism in the United States and Europe. They are an element of the Republican Party's opposition to abortion. Canadian governments have traditionally sought to overcome the challenges of labor shortages caused by declining fertility through wide open immigration.
Oh, okay, cool. That's great. So we can allow in more immigrants and create a better path towards citizenship for newcomers. That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, it's like
I'm glad John Ibbotson has come around.
There's like two options here I see. And one of those things is, you know, easier paths to citizenship for new Canadians, or better conditions for young families so that they can have kids and not have to worry about paying the bills and keeping the lights on and giving their children, the people that they're legally responsible for, a decent life, right? Like, there's two very simple solutions, and John is not going to explore either one of those.
The next paragraph is interesting. But revelations of international students flooding into Canadian colleges, some which are fake, to secure work permits, have undermined confidence in the system. In any case, the fertility rate in source countries is also in decline.
Oh no, not the system, not trust in the system. It sucks that there's no way to, like, make the system better.
Canada's immigration policies are quite racist in the way that they make it harder for people from specific countries to come in. And they're also very classist in where Like, you have to have like a specific amount of income. You have to be like a productive member of society. You have to be contributing to the economy in some way. And then when you get here,
you have to know English or French.
You have to know English or French. And then when you get here, if you're, you know, in a specialized field, there's a good chance your credentials are not going to be worth anything here. And so you're going to have to do, you know, gig economy work or work in, you know, the service industry while you go to school to do shit that you already knew how to do. I mean, essentially, I think what happens is like we build a working class of people from people that had a lot of money in other countries that are just like biting the bullet and coming over here. And I think John thinks that we can replace that by just having 10 trillion babies or something.
Right.
Which is actually not possible. Like, that's not going to happen.
It's the part that gets my back up, too. Yeah. The bit about the fertility rate in those source countries also being in decline. Like, what the fuck is he talking about?
It's not that big of a deal. There's lots of people. We're not going to run out of people anytime soon. Like,
yeah, right.
Like, is he like, worried about, like, there being less people to play badminton with? Like, I don't understand what the issue is.
He's hearkening to, like, Reagan's nuclear family. Like, as being like the ideal and like only acceptable like version of a family as well throughout this article, right? Like,
yeah,
suburbia, like that classic suburban life that everyone dreamed of like fucking 30 years ago, but like how many people seem to be aspiring to now?
It's not realistic to, and it's also, it's not that good. I mean,
it's working great for my sister, but like, you know what I mean? Like, that's not the majority right now, though. Like, that's not where most, speaking as an elder millennial, just age revealing here, but like, it ain't happening. And yeah, like, I hate this article. I hate it so much. There's only two paragraphs left. So go ahead, infill those neighborhoods with apartment buildings. Keep that farmland, keep that prime farmland pristine.
Like, that's not a huge deal.
Right, no big deal, right?
Food prices aren't skyrocketing. Like, what the mm-hmm. fuck, John?
Also, yeah, like sprawl. Like, who cares about sprawl? Like, go ahead. He continues in like last paragraph. Just don't act surprised when every year the fertility rate reaches a new low and social tensions a new high. Correlation isn't causation until it is.
Like, what?
So there it is, folks.
Jesus Christ! Fuck off.
The lack of suburban housing is what's causing fertility rates to decline, and yeah, density is just going to make that worse. I just like, what a fucking insane take. I this article actually like got me angry when I read it today. We were actually like considering, we were like, just like, I just want to say, like, we were thinking about talking about the Andrew Coyne piece earlier, and then we came across this and was just like, what the fuck. Decided to switch last minute to talk about Ibbotson's take on housing policy. So
I'm flabbergasted by like three sentences in those last two paragraphs. Like, keep that prime farmland pristine. Like, oh, like, keep your precious farmland so you can eat your food, you fucking idiot. Like, that's what that is. And it's like, okay, I will. But then correlation isn't causation until it is like a really dumb thing to say for like an adult human being.
Well, and how is there not an editor at the Globe and Mail who asked him, hey, John, do you explain what that means?
Like, when is correlation causation? Like, when is that point in this sentence? Like, what's the turning point?
It's like when a dummy with a national newspaper column says it is.
It's so embarrassing how little pushback these columnists get. They can just publish whatever dumb crap and their editors just lap it up.
You can't respond to it. You can't respond to it. Try pitching a response to the editor. Well, I mean, if you're me, you won't hear anything at all.
Yeah, no. You're blacklisted, buddy.
But if you're not me, they will either also ignore you or tell you, no thanks, not what we're looking for right now, or some dog shit.
Yeah, feel free to pitch again in the future, but I think we're good for that.
Yeah, oh, I look forward to hearing, yeah, fuck you, no you don't.
You don't mean that. Work. I do love the idea that babies are the only way to keep social tension low. Like, just like there's people walking around bars just holding babies out to stop fights. I think that's like a beautiful idea.
Well, everyone loves babies.
Yeah. It's like, you can't get in a bar fight with someone who has like a baby in one of those baby Bjorn things in front of them. Like, you would look like such a jerk.
Baby. Every time I go to a bar, I borrow a baby so I can just, like, wave it around to stop guys from trying to fight me.
You stop fights in the bar with the baby. You just...
Hey, no, you can't fight me. I wear glasses now, baby.
I think Ibbotson has a point, though, because no divorced couple with newborn has ever fallen over.
That is true.
So can I just ask one question before we let Jeremy go?
Absolutely.
What did we learn from this column?
That is true.
We got to have a million babies.
Okay, so Canada needs more babies.
We need more babies.
Correlation isn't causation.
And we all want to escape modernity on some level. And actually, truly,
I did not like that. Is something I've never fucking heard before.
And... Yeah, no, I've never heard that. I've never heard that idea before either. That's a new one. So thank you, John.
Yeah, let's do plugs and recs super quick. Jeremy, you got to go, so you go first.
So, you know that giant Zionist piss baby at Columbia University, Shai Davide, who is not the Toronto Blue Jays columnist.
Shai Davide, yeah.
Who is good. Knows a lot about baseball.
It's the Mario Greco of Shai Davide. It is.
Yeah. The guy at Columbia who is like, my students are all terrorists. We need the police to execute them. Well, Joshua Frank at Counterpunch did a nice little piece of investigative journalism looking into how Mr. Davide comes from a long line of arms dealers.
Oh. Huh.
Yeah. Would you believe that?
Right. I'd heard
of him. Yeah. He is very wealthy.
Oh, no way. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Money and arms dealing.
Yeah, I know. Now, I've seen everything. But his dad, Eli Davide, is the general manager of a company called ARC, which describes itself as a leading global advanced manufacturing service provider, including weapons parts such as polymer magazine for NATO compatible weapons, triggers and hammers, precision guided munitions components, and more. In 2016, this company got an award for an AR-15 component, and in 2010 was also awarded for an explosive device made for a Department of Defense application. It also makes a bunch of rifles that are used by the IOF, that's Israeli Occupation Force. So yeah, Shai Davide, son of an award-winning arms dealer.
You know, you really got to hand it to him.
Yeah. Anyways, read Counterpunch. They're great. I've was really honored when they've republished some of my writings on Palestine from the Orchard. And they're a great American media outlet from the left that I've been reading since I was in like high school and got like Noam Chomsky pilled. So yeah, shout out to Counterpunch and Joshua Frank, their managing editor.
All right, Steven, do you have anything you would like to recommend our listeners?
Yeah, just check out our work at pressprogress.ca. Sign up for our newsletter, Shiftwork, which I believe is the only newsletter in Canada covering labor issues. And also, I am on the Sources podcast, which I believe Eric is familiar with.
I edit it. They pay me money to edit it. It's important to me.
Yeah, Eric is our editor. So, yeah, that's a thing going on. We have some episodes coming up on the budget and other things. So, yeah. Otherwise, you can find me at Maguziak on Twitter, which is where I'm most active personally. And otherwise, yeah, I'd say that's about it.
Marino, do you have any plugs?
You know, I think The Grind has been doing a lot of good work recently, especially when it comes to covering protests, which are woefully undercovered by every other media outlet in the city. The violence at the Land Day March in particular, that piece was pretty good by David Gray Donald and Nerd Dogan. Yeah, that's pretty much it from me. I'll have maybe some new projects coming up in the upcoming year. I'll probably have more time on my hands. So, yeah.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, I guess the first thing I would recommend for listeners, because Ibbotson hints at it, about the international students coming over and the backlash against them. There's actually some really great work on Press Progress written by Ramnik Johal from February last year about the international student crisis, because believe it or not, things were not good for these people who came over and then found out that the school that they had signed up for was in a plaza and was not taking care of them. So there was a story that she wrote called "Dozens of International Students Are Dying in Canada. The Federal Government Isn't Doing Anything," that I think shed some light on what was going on last year in regards to international students. And it also kind of paints a picture of why John Ibbotson's like a dickhead for the way that he wrote about it in his piece, because he was only using it as a tool to explain why we need higher birth rates, right? And then, I mean, the other plugs I always have, as always, go to unrigged.ca, sign up for the newsletter. I'll drop a link in the show notes so you can sign up directly. You get a weekly just digest of five of the best stories that we have on the site from, I think it's 25 publishers. I'm going to say more than 20 publishers across Canada, and all very high quality outlets. I think Press Progress is on there. The Hoser's on there as well. You'll see some stuff about food prices there. But that's it for me. Stephen, it's always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you again for coming on.
You as well.
Oh, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, Eric.
Oh, you stop that. You stop that right now.
I'm going to start insulting you. This is one of my bits where I want to start like insulting Eric. This is like a heel turn, like wrestling style thing. Where I've been praising you for a year and then suddenly I become like an enemy. But I can't do that to you. You're too nice. You're too sweet. You can't be taken by conventional means.
No, you stop that right now. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
It's Big Shiny Takes, the only antifreeze beach podcast. Big Shiny Takes, reading garbage for your brain. It's Big Shiny Takes with Jeremy, Eric, and Marino. Big Shiny Takes are sure to entertain. Are sure to entertain.